think we read through Perek Chaf last week, if I am not mistaken, correct?
Yes.
What I call the battle plan. Battle number one, campaign number one, campaign number two, and ultimately campaign number three. And what we saw was that the first two times that Bnei Yisrael go out to war against Binyamin, with God's consent, and that's very important for us for the next piece of it, which we'll discuss when we get back after our short break. With God's consent, they go out to this campaign, and the first time they go against Binyamin for refusing to hand over the perpetrators, for defending the, or having the audacity to defend the perpetrators of Giv'ah, Bnei Yisrael lose the campaign. They lose that war, that offensive at that day, and 22,000. Then the next day they go back and they do it again, and another number, I think 18,000. So by the time we're done, we're at 40,000 gone. Then they come back to the Mishkan, they come back to Hashem, they ask, should they do it again? And this time Hashem says, yeah, go ahead, a third time, this time you'll be successful. There's a little more strategy, a little less arrogance, a little more prepared. They divide up into groups and into an ambush, and three arms, if you will, one that attacks the city straight on, kind of using the fact that they fell twice to create a false sense of security amongst the people of Binyamin. Binyamin come running out to them, thinking that they're going to destroy them. In the meantime, there's an ambush waiting behind them, behind the city, to raise the city, to attack the city, and to burn it. When the smoke goes up, the people of the army that had left the city realize that the city behind them had been left defenseless and that they are now surrounded and cut off.
That was Giv'ah, right?
That's Giv'ah. And then there's a third group that's of the rest of Bnei Israel that are lying in wait, waiting for this to all happen so that they can then pounce and then go and clean up and wipe out all the cities of Binyamin from one end of the Shevet to the other. And by the time it's all done, there's about 400 survivors of Binyamin hiding in the cleft of the rock of Selamimon. That's essentially, or 600. That is essentially where we left off. Correct?
Yes.
And that's cheery note. So take a look at the very last verse of the Perek.
321.
End of Chaf. We haven't touched Chaf Aleph. Vayifnu vayina. Starting with actually the second to last pasuk Mem Zayin. Vayifnu vayanusu hamidbara el sela harimon shesh miot ish. 600 survivors, 600 men ran off to sela rimon. They stayed there in hiding for 4 months. The Ish Yisrael, Ish Binyamin, always referring to as a singular unit, the army of Israel. The army is always referred to as, in this context, it's often referred to as Ish Yisrael, the force of Israel. Shavu el Bnei Binyamin, they came back now after they had destroyed the army of Giv'ah and the defenders of Giv'ah, and the battle really was won. Vayakum lefi cheref, and they smote them by the sword. Meir mitom ad behema, ad kol nimtza. City destroyed down to the last animal. Gam kol ha'arim nimtzaot shilchu ba'esh, and burnt, razed to the ground all of the cities of Binyamin. They literally destroyed whatever was in their path.
Men, women, and children.
Well, that's the way it's certainly been described. Certainly to, and burnt the city. A discussion as to what the role of non-combatants become in this kind of a context. But the notion of taking, after the battle is over, essentially Giv'ah is destroyed. The army of Giv'ah is destroyed. notion of going back now and cleaning up, if you will, by burning all the cities of Binyamin, it's a really remarkable statement. Really remarkable statement. And one that is important because the phraseology in this pasuk is not an accident. The phrases in this verse are not only are a very telling window into the mindset of what Bnei Yisrael was thinking and motivating their behavior. And as strange as it may seem, what's motivating their behavior, what's going through their minds, according to many, is actually a mitzvah in the Torah. Misread, misapplied, perhaps, but nonetheless, a mitzvah in the Torah. And it's the phraseology of this whole story that actually leads to this description. There are certain key phrases that we've seen. For example, Did I give you this chart? I gave you one chart that looked like that, but that was, a different one. I gave you the one that compared to Pileg Shpigiv and Sodom, correct?
Right.
Okay, so this is a different one. All right, so before I give it to you, actually, let's take a look at the mitzvah that I'm talking about, and we shall see. You know, if you have that source page, that map that I gave you with Lot, the back of it is the Ramban. If you don't have it, there's extras here. The two pager with the long Ramban that we started to look at.
Yeah.
You have that? You have that source page? There's extras here if anybody wants. I just want to show you a part of the Ramban. We had gotten up to, I think that's the last one I have. You have to share. You have the same one when we did the first part of this. If you take a look at this Ramban, the second page, remember, this was the Ramban. We compared the behavior of the people of Givah to the behavior of the people of Lot, to ask the question, who is worse? And ultimately, we had discussed the fact that what motivated the Ramban to discuss the question of why he felt that the people of Sodom behaved in a manner that was worse than the people of Givah was because when Bnei Yisrael go out to fight against Givah, they lose. So clearly, they couldn't have been that justified in the battle in the first place, if God essentially causes them to lose this battle. We'll come back to that question. That's the big theological question in this story. But take a look at on the right-hand column of the Ramban on the bottom. He says, "V'ine pinot kol ha'am mikol shiftei Yisrael ratzu lasot geder gadol b'davar la'amitotam." Everybody have it?
The last paragraph, but it's two-thirds down. Right side, right column, bottom paragraph.
It was the desire of the tribes of Israel gathered together to punish the perpetrators, in this case, the people of Givah. Give us the people of Givah, and we will kill them. V'davar baruhu, first he talks about this we read last time. V'davar baruhu shelo ayu chayvim mita b'din Torah, that the people of Givah, he claims, were not guilty of a capital offense, and therefore the effort of Bnei Yisrael to try to kill them was not necessarily justified. That we'll skip now for a moment. Skip down to the next bold phrase. Aval mipnei shehayu chafetzim v'yomrim la'asot nevala ke'anshei Sodom. Since the people of Givah had intended to behave in a Sodom-like manner, ra'u ha'shvatim la'asot siyag la'torah shelo ye'aseh v'lo ye'amer kem b'Yisrael. The people of Bnei Israel, they said, this is enough. We can't have a city in Israel behaving like a city, like the city of Sodom. This behavior must stop here. They decided to draw a line in the sand. And even though it may not necessarily have been completely mandated or legal, Kamo she'amru univara ra'a miYisrael, we will uproot this evil from Israel. וזה הדין וממה שאמרו רבותינו בית דין מקין ועונשין שלא מן התורה ולא לעבור על דברי תורה אלא לעשות סייג לתורה. Beit Din has at times an authority to expand their power of punishment, not necessarily because the Torah mandates this kind of punishment for this kind of action, but sometimes just to be able to preserve the rule of law in the community, to be able to preserve the integrity of the Torah, they would necessarily have expanded their jurisdiction.
So Siyag LaTorah is integrity of the Torah?
Siyag LaTorah is a fence that you place around the Torah. It's applied in different contexts. Normally we apply it in the context of Gzerot Rabbanan, which is there also to protect the integrity of the Torah by protecting certain rule laws that have boundaries that are too close. What they're talking about here is a different kind of application, but a simpler, but essentially the same idea, where it's the jurisdiction of the Beit Din that is expanded in order to protect the behavior, the moral behavior of the people.
How many years did we have this kind of jurisdiction?
Well, the Beit Din has an authority always. The question is its application here was probably misrepresented or abused, but he's less concerned with the question of the authorization or the jurisdiction of the Beit Din as much as he is with the behavior of Bnei Israel. He's borrowing phrases here. I don't think there was a formal Beis Din involved in this at all. He's borrowing phrases and concepts.
Because they don't go to the Beit Din, they go to Mishkan.
They go to the Mishkan. It's hard to imagine a lynch mob going to the Beit Din.
Are you imagining
that? Veshevet Binyamin lo hiskimu b'davar ze. Binyamin obviously didn't agree to this. Shelo haya behem chiyuv mita b'inui ha'pilegesh. They felt there was no capital offense. There was no crime of murder involved in this, and they were not prepared to hand over the people of Givah for the execution of the mob. V'ulai hikpidu od b'nei Binyamin ala shelo shalchu lehem mitchila v'yasu haskama shelo midata. Maybe Binyamin was additionally upset that B'nai Israel decided to just go to war against Givah without consulting with them, without discussing with them. Sheva Binyamin, what do you have to say about this? What's your opinion? Maybe you know more about it than we do. Maybe you have information that we don't have. There was no consultation with Binyamin. There was just a threat. Give us the people of Givah or we will wipe you out. Ulefi da'ati sheze onsham sheYisrael lehinagef batchila. This is where he says it explicitly. Since that, says the Ramban, is in my opinion the reason why Bnei Yisrael, when they go to fight in the first place, they lose the campaign the first time around and the second time around. Because this was not a justifiable war. This was not a war that had any kind of legal jurisdiction, justification, legitimacy. The hageder atzmo shel hashevet Binyamin haya mutar la'asoto v'lo aleihem. Very important phrase. It says, if anybody was responsible for holding Giv'ah accountable for their actions, it should have been Shevet Binyamin. Because there is a jurisdiction within each Shevet for the rule of law in the cities within that Shevet. Use the It's not exactly a good analogy because the United States is built in a much more rigid structure than the relationship of the Shvatim was at that time. But the analogy isn't so far afield from the jurisdiction of the federal government versus the state government. Ultimately, jurisdiction over law and order within the cities, within a state, is the responsibility of the state, not of the federal government. The tribes of Israel coming together to essentially perpetrate, to essentially hold Givah accountable by the sword and bypass Shevet Binyamin altogether, is essentially the foundation of a civil war, says the Ramban, wasn't justified on any account. First of all, they overreacted. There was no justification for wiping out the people of Givah. There was no moral, there was no capital offense created for which there could have been war. And second of all, it was Binyamin's responsibility. Right? It was Binyamin's responsibility. What responsibility did the rest of the tribes of Israel have? Right? But Binyamin obviously wasn't going to do anything. So this Levi decided to take it upon himself to involve the rest of the tribes of Israel.
So was it political? I mean, was it entirely political?
I actually don't think it's political at all. I think it's deeply religiously motivated.
So they weren't, like, looking for an excuse?
No, I think they were motivated by what they saw. Remember the parcel package?
Yeah.
Right? And vengeance against this evil. The phraseology that they use, Nivara'azot mi Yisrael, we will uproot this evil, Ubi'artara mi kirbecha, to uproot the evil from your midst, to destroy the city, to raise it to the ground, burn the cities. These are phrases that are deeply religious phrases. And they come from a particular place that I think misrepresented and misapplied had devastating consequences. So at the end of the shiur last week, I suggested that what might be motivating this is a comparison to the story of the Ir HaNidachat. Anybody remember the discussion?
Yeah.
We said briefly we were going to address that. We didn't get to it, correct?
You just mentioned that.
I mentioned it.
There's a halacha that you have to utterly
right.
destroy.
So let's take a look at that mitzvah.
Right.
Let's take a look at that mitzvah, because I think ultimately, both in terms of the mindset of... She remembers everything.
So don't say anything.
One week isn't that long. Ask me 2 weeks.
Good memory. We can't remember what happened 5 minutes ago.
That's right. I didn't remember last week.
You always need one in the class to keep you on your toes. That's why it's important. Devarim Perek Yud Gimel is where we're going to end up. Devarim Perek Yud Gimel. I'll tell you in a minute. But first you need to know the context of this perek. Right. We have looked at various pieces of this parsha before. If you remember our discussion about the mandate to go into the land of Israel and create an idolatry-free zone in the land of Israel, to destroy all the altars and all the high places, and to recognize, we had the discussion about the notion of the Mishkan as one place to serve God, and the notion of idolatry as being on multiple hills and in multiple cities and multiple places, because idolatry was pagan by its nature. Multiplicity of the Godhead, many places of worship. Monotheism, by its very core, meant one God, one temple, one place. We talked about that at the very beginning of Pilagish Begivah or Pesach Micha, where we talked about the notion of consolidating religious service in one location. At Pesach Micha, we had that conversation. That's also in this parsha. That's Perek Yud Aleph. Parshat Re'eh, as a whole, deals with the whole notion of idolatry and the relationship to idolatry. So, from various facets, back at the beginning of the parasha, Perek Yud Aleph deals and Yud Bet deals with this issue of the place that God will choose, the relationship Perek Yud Bet in particular, the place that God will choose for the Mishkan, for the Mikdash, and the prohibition of idolatry on multiple locations. Parak Yud Gimel is the flip side. Parak Yud Gimel deals with the consequences of idolatry in the land of Israel. Once we've established that the land of Israel has to be an idolatry-free zone, now there are consequences. What happens if you don't go there? What happens if you don't listen and you end up with idolatry in the land? Now, if you... background information, just open parentheses for a minute. Way back when we started Sefer Yehoshua. Anybody remember learning Sefer Yehoshua?
Yes.
Around this table, we learned... Around this table, we learned Sefer Yehoshua. Right? We started when with Epstein, that's right. We started at Epstein for 1 year, and then we moved it here. That's right, way back when. That's right.
That was before my time.
No, but we've continued it here. We had a discussion about why idolatry was so intense an issue for the Torah. Why does the Torah go to such lengths to, if you'll forgive the expression, go to war with idolatry? And what we discussed was the fact that idolatry wasn't just about worshipping God versus worshipping alternative gods. Idolatry was a culture which was inherently immoral. It included virgin rape sacrifices, child sacrifices, it included murder, it included virtually all. And when Chazal talk about the three mitzvot which a person has to sacrifice their life rather than violate, murder, adultery, and idolatry, it's because they're all three interconnected. And in the pagan culture, they are essentially intertwined. So the morality of idolatry is not just a theological one, it's really an immoral one. The culture of idolatry is really an inherently immoral culture. And you can't separate that, because otherwise you really lose perspective on why the Torah goes to such lengths to mandate a total eradication of idolatry from the land of Israel. It's much bigger than just monotheism. It's about a whole moral code of the seven Sheva Mitzvot Bnei Noach and all that is inherent in that mandate. Now, having said that, Parak Yud Gimel deals with the flip side. What happens when you find yourself in a situation in the land of Israel and there are aspects of idolatry that are creeping up? So, for example, the first piece of it, the beginning of the Parak, is about false prophets, Navi Sheker. A false prophet is a person who speaks in the name of God to encourage others to worship idols. And then there's two types of false prophets. There's a Navi Sheker, and there's a Navi Lavarazara. A Navi Lavarazara is a Navi, is a person who speaks in the name of God to try to encourage others to worship idols. Ki Yakum B'Kirbecha, starting with Pasuk Bet. Ki Yakum B'Kirbecha Navi Yochalem Chalom. A person will arise, call himself a Navi, or a dreamer. He may even give you miracles. He may even do signs and miracles to try to convince you of his authenticity. And those miracles may even take place. But his message is, his message would lead you to idolatry, to a false god, to a false religion, to a false culture. Then, you not only do you not listen to such a Navi, he's a test, you have to stand up to the test, then you have a mandate, that is a capital offense, and the Navi needs to be put to death. So you have this theme that essentially takes us from the notion that idolatry is a capital offense to those who lead others to idolatry is in itself a capital offense. You with me?
Mm-hmm.
Pasuk Zion. Pasuk Zion goes one step further. So here we talked about a Navi, Perek Chav Pasuk Zion. Here we talked about a Navi who leads others to idolatry. Then we get Pasuk Zion, Ki yisitcha achicha ben imecho ovincha ovitcha o eshet chekecha o re'echa asher kenafshecha baseter lemor. Let's say you have anybody else, a brother, a sister, a wife, a spouse, a friend, doesn't matter. No matter how close they are, if they, in secret, in private, tell you, encourage you, to worship idols, we call this a mesit, a mesit is an enticer to idolatry, and an enticer to idolatry is also a capital offense. Somebody who entices others to go to idolatry is a capital offense. Kerog targenu, they should be killed by the Beitin. So now we have a Navi who leads others to idolatry. We have just an ordinary person, a mesit, who's an enticer to idolatry. All of these are capital offenses. This is essentially the theme of the perek. This perek addresses situations of individuals and or groups who lead others towards idolatry, and thereby the idolatrous perpetrators will be guilty of a crime for which the Torah considers a capital offense. The insider is also so judged.
Was Lavan in this capacity?
Who?
Lavan.
How did we get to Lavan?
Because he's enticed. Right. His enticement or not?
Lavan? How do we get to Lavan? Yaakov and Lavan? Are they in the story of Yaakov and Lavan?
No, just any other person who is an enticement to idolatry.
Right. He may have been an idol worshiper. There's nothing in the story that talks about worshiping idols, but maybe the Trefim. But no,
that's not the same.
No.
Obviously.
I've asked the question: are you a chiyuv to kill any idol worshiper that you know?
So technically, you individually, not necessarily the Beit Din. Yes, Beit Din. There's a process. It's a process by which a person has to be, has to be investigated, etc. But if it's found to be true, right, idol worshiping is a capital offense.
But today we don't really have.
Today we don't have anything. We don't have the jurisdiction of the Beit Din today. None of this applies today.
But
that's
in
much
general,
more philosophical.
You don't have worshiping
we don't
like
have no.
You don't have people
correct.
Sacrificing kids.
Correct. 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 None of this is. Let's clarify this. None of this is applicable today. That's not our issue. The issue isn't whether it's applicable today. The issue is whether it's applicable to the world of the Givah and the world of Pilagish. That's our issue. None of it is in practical terms. No Beit Din is going to stand up and say, "Okay, let's execute for adult." Right, then we get to the subject under discussion, which is the Ir HaNidachat, Pasuk Yud Gimel. Ki Tishma Ba'achat Arecha, Asher Hashem Elokecha Naten Lecha, Lashevet Shem Limor, in one of the cities that God has given you to dwell there, you hear the following. What do you hear? Now listen to the phraseology, because you're going to hear phrases that are going to be familiar to you. Yatzu anashim b'nei b'liya'al mikirbecha. In this city, there are people who are b'nei b'liya'al. Worthless, evil people. Vayadichu et yoshvei iram. We had a mesit, here we have a mediach. Similar idea, somebody who entices, who causes others to stray. Who caused the inhabitants of the city to stray, saying to the inhabitants of the city, Nelcha v'navda Elohim acharim asher lo yedatem. So we had let's go worship idols. So we had a Navi who encourages others to worship idols, and we had an individual who encourages others to worship idols. Now we have a group of people enticing an entire city. The Mediach entices an entire city. The city becomes a incited city, an Ir HaNidachat. The Mediach is the one who incites, the Nidachat is the one who is inside. Pasuk Tetvav, V'darashta, V'chakarta, V'sha'alta Heitev. You will investigate it. You will seek out. You will question well. You will conduct a thorough investigation of the matter. And if it found to be correct, Nesta hato'eva hazot bikirbecha, this abomination is in fact the case, you have an entire city that has been seduced to worshipping idols. Haket taket yoshve ha'ir ha'i lefichareth. You will smite the inhabitants of this city by the sword. Hacharem ota v'tkola sherba V'tkol behemta l'ficharev. You will utterly destroy the city and all that is there, including the animals, by the sword. V'tkol shlala tikpots. You will gather all the spoils of the city and bring them to the center of the city, al toch rechova. V'sarafta ba'esh et ha'ir v'et kol shlala kalil la'ashem elokecha. Will burn the property and the entire city to the ground. V'ayta tel olam. It will be a heap for eternity. Lo tibane od. It may never be rebuilt. V'lo yidbak bi'adcha me'umah min ha'cherem. You may not take anything of the cherem. Last time we discussed this was when?
Recently, maybe 2 weeks ago.
No.
No, it was much
further. Last time we had a cherem, which we would describe as a tel olam, can never be rebuilt, and you may not take and violate any part of the cherem. Yes, say it louder.
Yericho.
It was exactly the motivation behind Yehoshua's decree against Yericho. Was to look at Yericho as the center of idolatry of Israel at the time, and to declare it an Ir Nidach.
They
violated it, so that had other consequences.
Maybe I missed something, but where in Shoftim does it tell us that anything having to do with Givah had to do with idolatry?
We're going to come to that in a second. We're going to get to the Rambam now. That's exactly where we're going.
But the Tanakh doesn't tell us anything about their idolatry.
No. But the phraseology tells us that they ruled the city, that they behaved towards the inhabitants of the city in accordance with the behavior mandated for an Ir Nidachat. That's exactly the issue.
So it's a behavior.
Whether or not justified remains to be seen or to be judged.
A dishwasher. It's maybe spelled differently. Is a madiach? Is there
madiach
kalim?
What could be?
Do you know? Is it the same? It's just like maybe it washes away the bad stuff. I don't know.
Isn't that interesting? Why would they call it?
This you need a.
You said it doesn't apply from today.
I'm just saying the same thing.
Today, today's world, it doesn't apply.
Boy, talk about from the sublime to the ridiculous.
You have to remember,
it's going to help me.
Important things, and we remember the other things. I just didn't know it. I would have remembered it.
I'm sorry.
You can say I didn't wash dishes.
You didn't have a dishwasher.
Ship a dishwasher to Israel, you know.
Oh, see, I didn't have that one.
All right. I interesting. I'm not sure what to do with that. If you look at this page that I just handed out, or I'm handing out, actually, here's another one.
Go that way. Then, sorry, I didn't realize there was only one pile.
I'll take this one.
On the back of this is a second chart. On this second chart, what I tried to do was pull out the phrases that are indicators that somewhere along the line in the story of the Pilegesh, in their behavior towards the city of Givah, or the city of Binyamin, there was in the back of their minds, whether whether consciously or not, whether it was just that the author, right, when the Navi wrote Sefer Shoftim, he wanted us to make this association, so he wrote it with the text this way, or whether in fact this was their intention, we'll never know. But ultimately, there are phrases here that are tells, that are key tells that there's a connection between these two stories. So we saw some of them on Shebelein Belial. I've tried to chart out some of them. The first one that we just saw is Yatzu Anashim Bnei Belial Mikirbecha Beyadichu Et Yoshvei Iram. Similarly here, Anshei Ha'ir Anshei Bnei Belial Nasabu Et Habayit. Everybody see where I am?
Yeah.
Top? There are other phrases. For example, when the Torah tells us how to respond to an Ir Hanidachat, to investigate, to search, to be thorough in your analysis of the facts, v'nei emet nachon davar, until you discover that in fact this is true, what will you do? Ne'esta hato'eva azot bikirbecha. When you'll discover that this to'eva, this abomination, has in fact taken place in your midst. That phrase is also somewhat reminiscent of the phrase that we had by the Pilegesh, when the Pilegesh describes Asu Zimau Nivala, or Bnei Yisrael come together and they challenge the, when they tried to investigate what happened, right? What was the length, extent of their investigation? Bnei Yisrael, when they come together?
I didn't think they had a big investigation.
They didn't. They had some.
They
it was pretty brief.
They asked about the wickedness.
Yeah, they did ask.
Here, Pasuk Gimel. Vayishmu b'nei Binyamin ki alu b'nei Yisrael mitzvah v'yamu b'nei Yisrael davru echa niyta hara'a hazot. How could this evil have occurred? Levi piped up, told them what he wanted to tell them. Pasuk, right? The Levi piped up, told them what he wanted to tell them. Pasuk, hey, v'yakumu alai b'alei agiva. Actually, Pasuk vav, v'alchez b'filakshi. I took my Pilegesh that had already been killed, whatever, did what I did to her. Because this nivala, this abomination, had been perpetrated. Nivala, zima, toeva, all words essentially referring to the same thing. Similarly to the irani dachad, nesta toeva zot. I think the most important phrase here is how the story ends.
That was the whole investigation.
That's v'darashta v'chakarta. That's v'darashta v'chakarta v'sha'alta heitei v'inei emet nachon adavar.
But they didn't ever ask the people of Gibeah what explanation.
Of course not.
That's
exactly the point. Right? That's exactly the point, right? Here you have all of these phrases and all of these indicators that there's this intensity about the irani dachat, but in the end, the differences between these two, the context here is very dramatic. Take a look at the next phrase. This is really the most important, because what do they end up doing to the people of Binyamin?
They destroy them.
Pasuk Memchet, the Ish Yisrael, Shavu Obnei Binyamin, after Givah falls, after the battle is over. Now it's cleanup time. What do you do with Tiruni Dachat after you've discovered that the city is in fact a city that has been an idolatrous city, and after you've done this investigation, after you kill everybody and destroy the people and destroy the animals, then what do?
Then
you burn the city.
But do you think God had in mind that they do it to each other?
I don't want to get into the question of the Torah, the mitzvah of the Torah. That's a mitzvah of the Torah of Tiruni Dachat. We can talk about the context in which it was or wasn't applied. That's the issue for us. The issue here was the abuse of it. And V'ish Yisrael shavu b'nei Binyamin v'yakum lefi cherev me'ir mitom ad behema ad kol ha'nimtza gam kol ha'rim ha'nimtzaot shilchu ba'esh. They went through the cities one by one, smote them by the sword, down to the last animal, and took everything that was in the city, meaning all the spoils, all of the possessions. Shilchu ba'esh. There's only one context for such behavior. There's only one context in which such a mode could be applied, and that's the mitzvah of the ir nidachat. Haket taket yoshvei ha'ir ha'i lefichareth. Smite the inhabitants. Ve'et kol asher ba ve'et kol behemta lefichareth. All of the animals. Ve'et kol shlalat tikbot zol toch rechava. Gather all the spoils. Ve'sarafta ba'esh at ha'ir. So clearly from the behavior of Bnei Yisrael, when they walked and they marched through Binyamin, they marched through with this sense that this was an irani dachat. This was the equivalent of a wayward city that needs to be obliterated. In this case, it was a shevet, an entire tribe. But that's how the mob essentially descended upon Shevet Binyam.
It really wasn't just their justification.
I never said there was justification.
No. That was their justification to themselves for what they did.
Correct. That's their justification. They're being motivated in the sense, in the heat of the moment, in the mob scene of the moment, that you can take all kinds of ideas and models and distort them. And that's, I think, exactly what you have. The contrast to, in fact, how an Ir HaNidachat operated couldn't be more different. If you look at the way the Rambam describes how the mitzvah of Ir HaNidachat was to be applied, it's one of those mitzvot that ultimately could never actually happen because of the way in which...
I was going to say, was there ever a real case?
Probably not that we know of. Right? It's one of those rare cases where the requirements, the halachic requirements, created or understood to be around the process to get there, makes it virtually impossible. But take a look, for example, if you turn the page over, I'll show you the Rambam.
Also, Rabbi, when the whole mitzvah of Ir HaNidachat was given, would you have ever thought that it would be applied to a Jewish city?
Yes, it's only to a Jewish city. And Ir HaNidachat is specifically to a Jewish city. It's not... Oh, that's what your question was? Yeah, Ir HaNidachat is specifically... It talks about Achicha. Right? Achicha... No. The Canaanites is a separate mitzvah. That's the mitzvah. That's the war against the Canaanites to obliterate idolatry. This whole perek. That's why I showed you the context of the perek. The perek Yud Gimel is about Jews inciting other Jews to idolatry. The navi, the person who does it secretly, and then Anshei Bnei Bliyal, Yatsu Anshei Bnei Bliyal Mikirbecha. This is clearly a Jewish city. Take a look. I'll show you two phrases in the Rambam which are very very important for us. Source number three is the Rambam's description of the Ir HaNidachat. It says, Ech din Ir HaNidachat. How does the Ir HaNidachat work? Bizman shetiyeru yala asot Ir HaNidachat. First of all, it has to be in a time when the great Sanhedrin is sitting, the Sanhedrin Gedola, and it has to be in a time when you have... There are various structures that have to be in place before you can apply the din of an Ir HaNidachat. Beit Din HaGadol Sholchin. First of all, this is the responsibility of the Beit Din HaGadol. Beit Din HaGadol means you have a Sanhedrin. In the context of Shoftim, we don't have any kind of a Sanhedrin because there's no everything. Malchus, right? There's no kingship. There's no unified structure of government yet, so there's certainly no Sanhedrin. Beit Din HaGadol Sholchin V'dorshin V'chokrin. Those are the phrases in the mitzvah in the Torah, right? They have to investigate, they have to check. Ad sheyidu b'raya brura, till they have absolute certain proof. Shehudecha kol ha'ir. The entire city has been influenced. Or ruba. So there's a principle that ruba kukula. Majority, in this case, works against them. V'chazu l'avodat kochavim. And they've in fact returned to their idolatrous roots. Then, achakach, once that investigation has been done, now we have to go and investigate a second time. Sholchim lehem shnei tamidei chachamim. They send two of representatives of the Sanhedrin. Lehaziram, to warn them. Ulehachziram, and to give them an opportunity to do tshuva. Im chazru, if they respond and they do tshuva, v'yasu tshuva mutav, then great, wonderful. V'im ya'amdu ba'avlotan, and if not, if they still stand in their iniquity, Beit Din mitzavin lecho Yisrael. Then Beit Din is a responsibility to call all of Israel together. The other piece that I didn't mention earlier is the other comparison to the Ir HaNidachat, is that the responsibility for judging an Ir HaNidachat falls on the totality of Klal Yisrael. It's one of the rare cases where it is the responsibility of the national entity to take responsibility. Ir HaNidachat can't be the judgment of one shevet of another. It has to be, that's why it's the responsibility of the jurisdiction of the Sanhedrin HaGadol. And so you don't have a situation where a particular tribe takes its vengeance out on a particular city because it wants to get away with something. Mitzavid l'cho Yisrael alot alehen l'tzava. Hein tzarin alehem. They besiege the city, they surround the city. Until the city falls. Now, once the city falls, That doesn't mean you walk, march into the city and begin to execute everybody. Once the city falls, that just means you now have access to the city. Miyad marbim lahem bateidinim v'daninotam. The moment the city falls, now you're in control of the city. Now you establish courts throughout the city, virtually on every street. And the purpose of this court is to assess each individual within the city. So we started with the judgment of the city as a whole. Then we went to war to break the city's isolation. Once the city breaks, the siege is done, we march in. Then we come into the city and establish regional, local courts. Kol mi shebau alav shnei edim shavat kochavim machar sheitru oto mafishin oto. You need two witnesses that say that we saw this individual, we warned him that idolatry is a capital offense, and he defied the warning, and even so, with Yad Ramah, intentionally violated and worshipped idols. If you find such a person, you set them aside into one category of guilty. Nimtzu kol ha'ovdim miyuta. If the minority of the city, if after the local batei dinim are finished, and you find all these people who meet the criteria of witnesses, two witnesses, who say we warned the person and we told them that there would be a capital offense involved if they continued to do their idolatry, and they said even so, afal picha, and we want to do it anyway, then they're guilty of a capital offense, and only then could they be executed. If those categories of people end up being the miut, the minority, then they are dealt with, soklinotam, they're dealt with in a capital manner, that's the responsibility. But the rest of the city is free because it wasn't a majority of the city. Nimtzurubam, then if the majority, on the other hand, have been found to be in this category of de avodah zarah, with warning, with witnesses, with the whole geshaft, then malinotan lebet din hagadol v'gomim sham dinam. Then you take all the inhabitants of the city and you bring them to the Beit Din Hagadol in the Sanhedrin, and there you finish the jurisdiction of the court. Now it moves out of the city into the inhabitants of the city move from the city itself into the jurisdiction of the Sanhedrin in Yerushalayim. And then, of course, there's a different type of capital offense, different type of capital punishment, and the city is dealt with as an Ir HaNidachat.
But
there is a sense in the Torah, that's the mitzvah of Ir HaNidachat, that the city, once you've established that the vast majority of the city has reached a point where their idolatry has been so insolent, so in your face, so afal pichain, right, then you address the city as a whole. That's the issue of Ir HaNidachat.
Again, what
it says here.
Practically, it seems really hard to do that.
Correct.
That's the point.
It's virtually impossible to reach that point. But what you end up with in our case is, I mean, then we can start to talk about the differences between them. But what you end up with in our case is such an abuse of the system, because you've got this lynch mob that's calling Ir HaNidachat, so to speak, as a mantra, but from the world of, in fact, how Ir HaNidachat operated to the application to the world of the Givah is a world apart. Now, it is true that the Rambam goes one step further. The Rambam argues that whereas the concept of Ir HaNidachat applies in the Torah, the mitzvah, specifically to idolatry, theoretically, the reason why Ir HaNidachat was dealt with so intensely and so harshly was because underlining it is a kind of insolent Yad Ramah, hand high, in your face, antagonistic attitude to Torah authority and to God. There's this rebellion component built into the behavior of an entire city that stands up against the authority of Jewish life in this way. The Rambam argues, and he does so not in the Mishnah Torah in his halachic work, but in the Mor Nevuchim, his philosophical work, Rambam argues that it is possible to extend the concept, whether or not the perpetration or the punishment, I don't know, but certainly the concept of an Ir HaNidachat could be extended to other modes of rebellion. So, for example, he writes in source 4, Ha'oseh bi'yad rama, a person who sins presumptuously. Ha'mezid, impudent. She'a'iz panav, seeks vor b'farhesya, who shows impudence and seeks publicity to sin publicly. She'zeh eno over le'te'avon, he's not doing it because he's falling to temptation. He can't hold himself back. He's doing it because he wants to make a point. He wants to demonstrate rebellion against authority. Lachlok al Torah, v'lamod kenegda, to oppose Torah, to stand against it. Mipnei zeh amar et Hashem hu megadef. Such a person is the equivalent of a megadef. A megadef is a person who blasphemes God. And it does so, as the Torah describes it, b'yad rama, with a hand high. V'chein adin etzli b'chol avera sher yir'em imenu stirat ha-Torah ha-machloket kenegda. Similarly, I think it's the same a punishment would apply to any sin which involves rejection of the law or opposition to it, if it's done in such a way that it's clear, that it's open, that it's rebellious, that it's designed to challenge the foundational authority of Torah. Obviously, this only applies in the context where you have a Beit Din, where you have authority, where you have power, and you have control. But he argues that this is a notion of megadef, somebody who blasphemes God and who behaves not only with idolatry, but any transgression where the intention of the perpetrator is to publicly trample on the authority of Torah. Argues the Rambam, ki anshe ira nidachat. Like the behavior of the Irani Dachat. The punishment of the Irani Dachat is because of their rebellion, is because of their status as kofrim, not because that they committed idolatry. It's not the sin of idolatry that you're punishing them for. It's the open act of rebellion that has been so demonstrative as to involve an entire city of Israel.
Mm-hmm. In the previous paragraph, it says the majority are to be taken and put to death. So what happens to... It doesn't matter if the minority is not involved?
Essentially, it doesn't... The reality is that in such a situation, you it's almost impossible to have a situation where the vast majority are worshipping idols or behaving in such a fashion in an entire city... in such an insolent public manner, with warning, with etc., and not have the influence over the whole city. But in the end, that Torah does rule the city as a group. Correct. There is a collectiveness to that city. That city is right. It's the principle of ultimately you have to the person who remains in such an environment is
guilty by association.
Somewhat guilty by association. Right. Again, in practical terms, ideally, it was not supposed to happen. In the case of Pilegish, I think it was a perversion of it. But in the end, take a look at the last sentence. Last sentence, I think, is very interesting. He says, the last paragraph, V'ra'aya ledavar, this is proof that this is, in fact, the case, that you can judge the notion of an ira nidachat by kind of behavior for non-idolatrous events, as long as they're done publicly with that kind of insolence and chutzpah. Do you remember the story at the end of Sefer Yehoshua? When Reuven and Gad go back to the other side of the yard and they build a big mizbeach. And Bnei Yisrael is so angry that they built this mizbeach as an act of rebellion against the Mishkan, and they go. Pinchas leads a delegation to go to war with them. So what was the justification? To go to war against an entire tribe of Israel? Says the Rambam, the justification is exactly the same as the Irani Dachat. If you perceive the behavior to be this kind of public, demonstrative flaunting of the authority of Torah, then you have a responsibility to address it. And in the end, that ended b'chitov, that ended b'shalom, because they were able to explain that their actions weren't based on rebellion, it wasn't based on rejection, it was, right, there was a conversation to be had, there was no conversation with the Pilegish. But what's interesting to me is that the Rambam goes out of his way to extend the concept of an ira nidachat, the behavior, the rebellious behavior that mandated or that would motivate this kind of response, and then he goes and he points to examples. And the one example he points to is B'nai Gad or B'nai Reuven. But the one example he doesn't point to
is
Giva. Even though the language by us is so reminiscent of Anir Nidachat. Why? Why doesn't he point to us? Because it was so abusive. It was so clearly an abuse of that analogy. Right? This is not an Anir Nidachat. This is a lynch mob. There's no Beit Din here. There's no adjudication. There's no justification. The one conversation they have of Darashta v'chakarta v'sha'alta heitev, right? The cross-examination and investigation and thorough examination of the facts was what? Was half a conversation with the Levi?
Yeah. That's your
right? And to the leaders of Binyamin to turn them over.
But there was no investigation with the leaders of Binyamin. There was no conversation with Binyamin. There was hand over the perpetrators who were going to kill you all.
Right.
This was really the voice of the mob. And so the text begs the comparison to the Irini Dachat, not because it wants to tell us that there was a justification in that extension, but to emphasize, I think, the perversion of what this gathering of the tribes of Israel was really about.
But you did say that there was idol worship going on in Benjamin.
Yeah, it was idol worship.
Idol worship, no.
Ahar Ephraim was in Benjamin.
You mean Pesel Micha?
Yeah.
Yeah, but no more or less than this idol worshiping going on anywhere else in the land of Israel. That's Sefer Shoftim.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. That's the whole theme of Sefer Shoftim, that idolatry was there because we didn't.
That's the kettle calling the pot black.
That is the kettle calling the pot black.
So did they really wipe out the tribe of
So in the end of the story, the only survivors are 600 men who are hiding in the cleft of Selarimon. Hiding, 600 men survived in the caves. Now, what happens to those 600 and how we end up rehabilitating Sheva Binyamin is the story of Parakhav Aleph. But it gets a lot worse before it gets better. So we have work. We still have work to do because it still has to reach. We haven't reached rock bottom in the story yet. We have only gotten to, I would say, midway. In the rock bottom we have yet to get to. But we will get there in a moment. But I think probably the most powerful indicator of the contrast between the real mitzvah of Irini Dachat and the behavior of Bnei Yisrael in this context is how each of those two pieces end. What's the end of the Parsha Pilagish Begiva in contrast to the end of the mitzvah of Irin Nidachat? How does mitzvah of Irin Nidachat end?
That you wanted the people to do, you have a Beit Din and you want them to do shuv, and if they don't, then you
right, don't. So says the Rambam. But let's go back to the Torah, to the mitzvah in the Torah for a moment. Right, that's the language in the Rambam. But let's go back to the mitzvah in the Torah for a second. Dvarim Yud Gimel.
Right?
Page, I don't know, but it's Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Yud Yud Chet and Yud Tet, correct. So Yud Chet is after the last Pasuk is on the page, correct. I like to see it in the Chumash. V'lo yidbak b'yadcha ma'uma min acherem l'man yeshuv Hashem mecharon apol. You're not allowed to take any of the cherem. Once you destroy the city, the cherem is over. You're not allowed to touch it. To appease God's wrath, so to speak. God will have compassion upon you, as he has sworn to your forefathers. In order that you should listen to the voice of God, keep all the commandments to do that which is right in the eyes of God. Now, why is that so telling? Because how does the story of Pilagish Begiva end? Right?
Same words.
Almost, with one little difference. This I put on the bottom of the chart for you. V'yasu b'nei binyamin, v'yasu nashim misperim. They rehabilitate Sheva Binyamin, which is not our issue for now. V'yashuvu el nachalatam, v'yavnu atarim, v'yeshu bahem. They go back, they build cities, they go home to the various towns. It's interesting, they're rebuilding cities. V'yavnu atarim. they're rebuilding cities. In the case of Ir HaNidachat, they took a city and destroyed it. In the case of the rehabilitation of Shevet Binyamin afterwards, they have to rebuild cities. It's interesting, interesting contrast in and of itself. Bamim ahem ein melech b'Yisrael, ish hayashar b'inav yaseh. So here's the contrast. Pilegesh Begiva and Pesach Micha is all about ish hayashar b'inav yaseh. The results of the Ir HaNidachat leads to lasot hayashar b'nei Hashem. Interesting phrase. Right. They're completely different worlds. This is the story of a mob taking the law into their hands, taking society into their own hands, taking the judgment of a shevet into their own hands. There's no more devastating result of this kind of wayward, uncontrolled, unbridled passion than the story of Pelegesh Begiva. Ishi Yashar Beinav Yaseh. Each for their own eyes. Whereas with the Ir HaNidachat, with all of its complexity and all of its moral challenges, ultimately is designed for one thing. Lasot HaYashar Beinei Hashem. To encourage people to maintain some kind of recognition of the law and order and the responsibility of law and the authority of Torah and to maintain a society that's built around that. So that's the contrast between these two stories. We're going to stop here. It is 10:26. When we reconvene, which is going to be in the new year, secular year, we have
second semester.
We have one more perek to go through, and that's perek Chaf Aleph. So, in order to do that, I don't want to. It's valuable for us for not to lose the 3.5 weeks or so of time in remembering the details of the story.